Good evening, friends, and welcome to Sleepy Time Tales, a podcast aimed at helping you to get a good night's sleep. Do you find your mind plagued with the stresses of modern life, especially when the lights are out and you're trying to get a restful night? Does your spinning mind keep you awake? Follow my voice down the path towards a good night's rest. Listen to me tell a story that will keep your mind from wandering to your daytime problems, the ones you can't solve right now and will be easier to solve while rested. Listen to my voice and allow yourself to drift, following the twists and turns of the story, but slowly letting go and drifting into sleep. Before we get on with the show, I'd like to take a couple of minutes of your time and ask for a little bit of support. The show is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon, and I have to be honest, in the last year or so, if it hadn't been for them, I don't think I could have kept this show going. I'm hearing from people all the time how valuable they find it, and those supporters who have the means to help fund the show, to keep it going, and help me to reach new audiences, are very much appreciated. So if you're making use of Sleepy Time Tales regularly to help you to deal with sleeplessness, and you have the urge to support the show, and most importantly, if you can afford it, please check out patreon.com/sleepytimetales or go to the link in the show notes or from the website to take a look. Or if you're more inclined to make a once-off contribution, then take a look at buymeacoffee.com/sleepytimetales. That's also linked in the show notes. And there you can buy me a coffee or the equivalent without even needing to sign up for the service. But another huge way you can help Sleepy Time Tales to grow is simply to spread the word. If there is someone in your life who you think will benefit from listening to it, just let them know. If you recommend the show on social media, please make sure to tag me in so that I can see and I can thank you. The tag is @SleepyTimeTales on either Instagram or Twitter. I don't often bring up reviews on the podcast, but I want to give a couple of shout outs to some recent ones. First off, thanks to Lex on Apple Podcasts, who says they find my voice calming and is one of those people who lets the show play all night. They specifically mention that the music in between isn't disturbing and leaves you to sleep. And from my side, I think the new music is even better for that. And also, is it a better volume? I have improved that particular little feature, I think. Also, unexpectedly spotted a review on Podcast Addict, which was a surprise. Apologies to ThreeSail, who made this review in December and I only saw it the other day. They put on several episodes and, according to them, had the best natural sleep in a while. Thank you very much, ThreeSail, and I hope your natural sleep has continued since you left that review quite a while ago. I'd also like to just take a couple of seconds to, on a more serious and less personal to me note, is I got an email recently from Emma, who thanked me for mentioning Black Lives Matter issues back when the protests were at their peak and were all over the news last year. She points out very fairly, though, that since those protests sort of faded out of the news cycle, this sort of thing has fallen out of the wider consciousness. So she asked me to share an article that links 150 Black-owned businesses to support. Because Black communities have been disproportionately affected by COVID as well as other structural issues. And if we can, we should give them some support. The article is up on Website Planet, and you will see the link for that in the show notes as well. Thank you, Emma, for pushing me on this. I appreciate it, and I hope people support some of these very well-deserving businesses, because I looked at some of their stuff, and it is all very cool, and all sorts of different businesses as well, from food to fashion to all sorts of things. So there's something there for everybody, so please take a look. And of course, last but very much not least, I need to shout out the music. Thanks to Kumiku for the track Sweet Night and Friends, which is among most of the music they release on Creative Commons for pretty much any use you can come up with. Their stuff is very cool and available on their website at loyaltyfreakmusic.com, and is there's a lot of very cool stuff there that's nice to listen to and also potentially useful for anybody with creative projects. So I've linked their website in the show notes as well, along with everything else. So you can go take a look. Thank you for taking these few minutes to listen to me babble, and let's get back to the show. So what exactly is Sleepy Time Tales? What is it for? It's a bit of a strange idea after all, a podcast that you're supposed to fall asleep to. But lack of sleep is a health crisis in the 21st century, and this is a podcast that is intended to help those that it can to get a restful night. Do you find yourself lying awake at night, with your mind spinning and emotions in turmoil with anxieties of 21st century life? Do you wake up in the middle of the night and find yourself not quite able to doze back off at 3 a.m? I'm here to help. My name is Dave, and I'm your narrator, here to help you into a restful night. Sleepy Time Tales is intended to be used as a distraction to what keeps you awake at night, or sometimes background noise or maybe company. That's why I keep the episodes quite long, so that I'm here for you, without any pressure of the end coming anytime soon. There are a couple of different ways to engage with the show. For me, when I struggle to sleep, I actually need something to focus on. A story or event that lets me keep my mind on a specific point, to stop it from spinning out into stresses and anxieties. To focus just enough not to resist the embrace of a night's sleep when it comes for me. The second way is, for some people just need a background noise. Some kind of white noise, whether it's the sound of the ocean, or wind in the trees, or rain, or just some boring dude telling you a story. But however you engage with the show, it's very important that you don't try to force the sleep. Just keep a light mental grip on my voice and on the thread of the tale, and allow the need for sleep to come for you when it's natural. Now obviously I'm hoping that you're asleep before I get to the end of the episode, but it's important that you don't feel pressurized. If this is your first night, it probably won't work for you. I suggest giving it a solid 3 nights try, just to try to get used to the idea, to get used to listening to my voice, my maybe slightly strange accent, maybe just the strangeness of the idea. Also, maybe despite the fact that it goes on quite long, maybe one episode just isn't long enough. Because maybe your problem isn't so much going to sleep. Maybe your problem is waking up in the middle of the night. What I recommend, because it's what works for me with the podcast that I listen to, is I let my shows run all night. I make a playlist of the shows that I listen to and let them usually start with the latest and then let them go. That way, when I wake up at 3 a.m, which is almost inevitable, the stream is still running and I pop my earbuds back in and go back to sleep. Sometimes even I find myself waking up 30 minutes or 60 minutes before my alarm and I do the exact same thing. Pop the earbuds back in because they've probably fallen out because I'm a bit of a restless sleeper. And whoop, there I go, back to sleep again. And you may wonder, Dave, what exactly is the point of that? What is an extra 30 minutes of sleep? And I've got to tell you, believe it or not, that can sometimes be the best part of my night. There's something about allowing yourself to sleep right before the alarm that is just biologically satisfying on a whole new level. But however you're engaging with the show and whatever time of the night you're engaging with it, or even early morning, it is important that you try to relax. If you're new to the show and prone to late nights lying staring at the ceiling, this will probably seem strange to you, so just give it a chance. Because I'm here to work with you, to create a safe space, a cocoon in which you can curl up and allow nature to take its course. So if you're still with me, thank you for staying. If you're already asleep, we'll chat again soon. And of course, you aren't hearing me, except maybe in a dream. In the Days of the Comet by H.G. Wells. Chapter the First, Dust in the Shadows, Section 3. That made Pollard put down the opera glass and look at me. "It's a bad time to change just now," he said, after a little pause. Rawdon had said as much, in a less agreeable tone. But with Pollard I felt always a disposition to the heroic note. "I'm tired," I said, "of humdrum drudgery for other men. One may as well starve one's body out of a place as starve one's soul in one." "I don't know about that altogether," began Pollard slowly. And with that we began one of our interminable conversations, one of those long, wandering, intensely generalizing, diffusely personal talks that will be dear to the hearts of intelligent youths until the world comes to an end. The change has not abolished that, anyhow. It would be an incredible feat of memory for me now to recall all that meandering haze of words. Indeed, I recall scarcely any of it, though its circumstances and atmosphere stand out, a sharp, clear picture in my mind. I posed after my manner and behaved very foolishly, no doubt, a wounded, smarting egotist, and parlored played his part of the philosopher, preoccupied with the deeps. We were presently abroad, walking through the warm summer's night, and talking all the more freely for that. But one thing that I said I can remember. "I wish at times," said I, with a gesture at the heavens, "that comet of yours or some such thing would indeed strike this world, and wipe us all away, strikes, wars, tumults, loves, jealousies, and all the wretchedness of life." "Ah," said Parload, and the thought seemed to hang about him. "It could only add to the miseries of life," he said irrelevantly, when presently I was discoursing of other things. "What would? Collision with a comet. It would only throw things back. It would only make what was left of life more savage than it is at present." "But why should anything be left of life?" said I. That was our style, you know. And meanwhile we walked together up the narrow street outside his lodging, up the stepway and the lanes towards Clayton Crescent and the high road. But my memories carry me back so effectually to those days before the change that I forget that now all these places have been altered beyond recognition. That the narrow street and the stepway and the view from Clayton Crest, and indeed all the world in which I was born and bred and made, has vanished clean away, out of space and out of time, and well nigh out of the imagination of all those who are younger by a generation than I. You cannot see as I can see, the dark empty way between the mean houses, the dark empty way lit by a bleary gas lamp at the corner. You cannot feel the hard, checkered pavement under your boots. You cannot mark the dimly lit windows here and there, and the shadows upon the ugly and often patched and crooked blinds of the people cooped within. Nor can you presently pass the beer house with its brighter gas and its queer screening windows, nor get a whiff of foul air and foul language from its door, nor see the crumpled furtive figure, some rascal child, that slinks past us down the steps. We crossed the longer street, up which a clumsy steam tram, vomiting smoke and sparks, made its clangorous way, and down which one saw the greasy brilliance of shop fronts and the naphtha flares of hawkers' barrows dripping fire into the night. A hazy movement of people swayed along that road, and we heard the voice of an itinerant preacher from a waste place between the houses. You cannot see these things as I can see them, nor can you figure, unless you know the pictures that great artist Hyde has left the world, the effect of the great hoarding by which we passed, lit below by a gas lamp and towering up to a sudden sharp black edge against the pallid sky. Those hoardings, they were the brightest coloured things in all that vanished world. Upon them, in successive layers of paste and paper, all the rough enterprises of that time joined in chromatic discord. Pull vendors and preachers, theatres and charities, miraculous soaps and astonishing pickles, typewriting machines and sewing machines mingled in a sort of visualized clamour. In passing that, there was a muddy lane of cinders, a lane without a light that used its many puddles to borrow a star or so from the sky. We splashed along unheeding as we talked. Then across the allotments a wilderness of cabbages and evil-looking sheds, past a gaunt abandoned factory and so to the high road. The high road ascended in a curve past a few houses and a beer house or so, and round until all the valley in which four industrial towns lay crowded and confluent was overlooked. I will admit that with the twilight there came a spell of weird magnificence over all that land, and brooded on it until dawn. The horrible meanness of his details was veiled. The hutches that were homes, the bristling multitudes of chimneys, the ugly patches of unwilling vegetation amongst the makeshift fences of barrel stave and wire. The rusty scars that framed the opposite ridges where the iron ore was taken, and the barren mountains of slag from the blast furnaces were veiled. The reek and boiling smoke and dust from the foundry, pot bank and furnace, transfigured and assimilated by the night. The dust-laden atmosphere that was grey oppression through the day became at sundown a mystery of deep translucent colours, of blues and purples, of sombre and vivid reds, of strange bright clearnesses of green and yellow athwart the darkling sky. Each upstart furnace, when its monarch sun had gone, crowned itself with flames. The dark cinder heaps began to glow with quivering fires, and each potbank squatted rebellious in a volcanic coronet of light. The empire of the day broke into 1,000 feudal baronies of burning coal. The minor streets across the valley picked themselves out with gas lamps of faint yellow that brightened and mingled at all the principal squares and crossings with the greenish pallor of incandescent mantles and the high cold stare of the electric arc. The interlacing railways lifted bright signal boxes over the intersections and signal stars of red and green in rectangular constellations. The trains became articulated black serpents, breathing fire. Moreover, high overhead, like a thing put out of reach and near forgotten, Pollard had rediscovered a realm that was ruled by neither sun nor furnace, the universe of stars. This was the scene of many a talk we two had held together, and if in the daytime we went right over the crest and looked westward, there was farmland. There were parks and great mansions, the spire of a distant cathedral, and sometimes, when the weather was near raining, the crests of remote mountains hung clearly in the sky. Beyond the range of sight, indeed, out beyond, there was Checkshill. I felt it there always, and in the darkness more than I did by day, Checkshill and Nettie. And to us two youngsters, as we walked along the cinder path beside the rutted road and argued out our perplexities, it seemed that this ridge gave us compendiously a view of the whole world. There, on the one hand, in a crowded darkness about the ugly factories and workplaces, the workers herded together. Ill-clothed, ill-nourished, ill-taught, badly and expensively served at every occasion in life, uncertain even of their insufficient livelihood from day to day. The chapels and churches and public houses swelling up amidst their wretched homes, like saprophytes amidst a general corruption, and on the other, in space, freedom and dignity, scarce heeding the few cottages, as overcrowded as they were picturesque, in which the labourers festered, lived the landlords and masters, who owned pot banks and forge and farm and mine. Far away, distant, beautiful, irrelevant, from out of a little cluster of second-hand bookshops, ecclesiastical residences, and the inns and incidentals of an in-decaying market town, the Cathedral of Lowchester pointed a beautiful, unemphatic spire to vague, incredible skies. So it seemed to us that the whole world was planned in these youthful first impressions. We saw everything simple, as young men will. We had our angry, confident solutions, and whosoever would criticize them was a friend of the robbers. It was a clear case of robbery, we held, visibly so. There in these great houses lurked the landlord and the capitalist, with his scoundrel the lawyer, with his cheat the priest, and we others were all victims of their deliberate villainies. No doubt they winked and chuckled over their rare wines, amidst their dazzling, wickedly dressed women, and plotted further grinding in the faces of the poor. And amidst all the squalor, on the other hand, amidst brutalities, ignorance, and drunkenness, suffered multitudinously their blameless victim, the working man. And we, almost at the first glance, had found all this out. It had merely to be asserted now with sufficient rhetoric and vehemence to change the face of the whole world. The working man would arise, in the form of a labour party, and with young men like Pollard and myself to represent him, and to come to his own, and then? Then the robbers would get it hot, and everything would be extremely satisfactory. Unless my memory plays me strange tricks that does no injustice to the creed of thought and action that Pollard and I held as the final result of human wisdom. We believed it with heat, and rejected with heat the most obvious qualification of its harshness. At times in our great talks we were full of heady hopes of the near triumph of our doctrine. More often our mood was hot resentment at the wickedness and stupidity that delayed so plain and simple a reconstruction of the order of the world. Then we grew malignant and thought of barricades and significant violence. I was very bitter, I know, upon this night of which I am now particularly telling, and the only face upon the hydra of capitalism and monopoly that I could see at all clearly smiled exactly as old Rawdon had smiled when he refused to give me more than a paltry 20 shillings a week. I wanted intensely to solve my self-respect by some revenge upon him, and I felt that if it could be done by slaying the hydra, I might drag its carcass to the feet of Nettie and settle my other trouble as well. What do you think of me now, Nettie? That at any rate comes near enough to the quality of my thinking then, for you to imagine how I gesticulated and spouted to Pollard that night. You figure us as little black figures, unprepossessing in the outline, set in the midst of that desolating night of flaming industrialism, and my little voice with a rhetorical twang, protesting, denouncing. You will consider these notions of my youth poor, silly, violent stuff. Particularly if you are of the younger generation born since the change, you will be of that opinion. Nowadays the whole world thinks clearly, thinks with deliberation, pellucid certainties. You find it impossible to imagine how any other thinking could have been possible. Let me tell you then how you can bring yourself to something like the condition of our former state. In the first place, you must get yourself out of health by unwise drinking and eating, and out of condition by neglecting your exercise. Then you must contrive to be worried very much and made very anxious and uncomfortable, and then you must work very hard for 4 or 5 days and for long hours every day at something too petty to be interesting, too complex to be mechanical, and without any personal significance to you whatever. This done, get straight away into a room that is not ventilated at all, and that is already full of foul air, and there set yourself to think out some very complicated problem. In a very little while, you will find yourself in a state of intellectual muddle, annoyed, impatient, snatching at the obvious presently and choosing and rejecting conclusions haphazard. Try to play chess under such conditions and you will play stupidly and lose your temper. Try to do anything that taxes the brain or temper and you will fail. Now the whole world before the change was as sick and feverish as that. It was worried and overworked and perplexed by problems that would not get stated simply, that changed and evaded solution. It was in an atmosphere that had corrupted and thickened past breathing. There was no thorough cool thinking in the world at all. There was nothing in the mind of the world anywhere but half-truths, hasty assumptions, hallucinations and emotions. Nothing. I know it seems incredible that already some of the younger men are beginning to doubt the greatness of the change our world has undergone. But read. Read the newspapers of that time. Every age becomes mitigated and a little ennobled in our minds as it recedes into the past. It is the part of those who, like myself, have stories of that time to tell, to supply, by a scrupulous spiritual realism, some antidote to that glamour. Section 4. Always with Pollard, I was chief talker. I can look back on myself with, I believe, an almost perfect detachment. Things have so changed that indeed now I'm another being, with scarcely anything in common with that boastful, foolish youngster whose troubles I recall. I see him vulgarly theatrical, egotistical, insincere. Indeed, I do not like him, save with that instinctive material sympathy that is the fruit of incessant intimacy. Because he was myself, I may be able to feel and write understandingly about motives that will put him out of sympathy with nearly every reader. But why should I palliate or defend his quality? Always, I say, I did the talking, and it would have amazed me beyond measure if anyone had told me that mine was not the greater intelligence in these wordy encounters. Pollard was a quiet youth, and stiff and restrained in all things, while I had that supreme gift for young men and democracies, the gift of copious expression. Pollard I diagnosed in my secret heart as a trifle dull. He posed as pregnant quiet, I thought, and was obsessed by the congenial notion of scientific caution. I did not remark that while my hands were chiefly useful for gesticulation or holding a pen, Pollard's hands could do all sorts of things, and I did not think, therefore, that the fibers must run from those fingers to something in his brain. Nor, though I bragged perpetually of my shorthand, of my literature, of my indispensable share in Rawdon's business, did Pollard lay stress on the conics and calculus he mugged in the organized science school. Pollard is a famous man now, a great figure in a great time. His work upon intersecting radiations has broadened the intellectual horizon of mankind forever. And I, who am at best a hewer of intellectual wood, a drawer of living water, can smile, and he can smile, to think how I patronized and posed and jabbered over him in the darkness of those early days. That night I was shrill and eloquent beyond measure. Rawdon was, of course, the hub upon which I went around. Rawdon and the Rawdon-esque employer and the injustice of wage slavery and all the immediate conditions of that industrial blind alley of which it seemed our lives were thrust. But ever and again I glanced at other things. Nettie was always there in the background of my mind, regarding me enigmatically. It was part of my pose to Pollard that I had a romantic love affair somewhere away beyond the sphere of our intercourse, and that note gave a Byronic resonance to many of the nonsensical things I produced for his astonishment. I will not weary you with too detailed an account of the talk of a foolish youth who was always distressed and unhappy, and whose voice was balm for the humiliations that smarted in his eyes. Indeed, now in many particulars I cannot disentangle this harangue of which I tell from many of the things I have said in other talks to Pollard. For example, I forget if it was then or before or afterwards that, as if it were by accident, I let out what might be taken as admission that I was addicted to drugs. "You shouldn't do that," said Pollard suddenly. "It won't do to poison your brains with that." My brains, my eloquence, were to be very important assets to our party in the coming revolution. But one thing does clearly belong to this particular conversation I am recalling. When I started out, it was quite settled in the back of my mind that I must not leave Rawdon's. I simply wanted to abuse my employer to Pollard. But I talked myself quite out of touch with all the cogent reasons there were for sticking to my place, and I got home that night, irrevocably committed to a spirited, not to say defiant, policy with my employer. "I can't stand Rawdon's much longer," I said to Pollard, by way of a flourish. "There's hard times coming," said Pollard. "Next winter." "Sooner. The Americans have been overproducing and they mean to dump. The iron trade is going to have convulsions." "I don't care. Potbanks are steady." "With a corner in borax?" "No, I've heard." "What have you heard?" "Office secrets. But it's no secret there's trouble coming to potters. There's been borrowing and speculation. The masters don't stick to one business as they used to. I can tell that much. Half the valley may be playing before 2 months are out." Pollard delivered himself of this unusually long speech in his most pithy and weighty manner. Playing was our local euphemism for a time, when there was no work and no money for a man. A time of stagnation and dreary, hungry loafing day after day. Such interludes seemed in those days a necessary consequence of industrial organization. "You'd better stick to Rawdon's," said Pollard. "Ugh," said I, affecting a noble disgust. "There'll be trouble," said Pollard. "Who cares?" said I. "Let there be trouble. The more the better. The system has got to end sooner or later. These capitalists with their speculation and corners and trusts make things go from bad to worse. Why should I cower in Rawdon's office like a frightened dog while hunger walks the streets? Hunger is the master revolutionary. When he comes, we ought to turn out and salute him. Anyway, I'm going to do so now. That's all very well, began Parload. I'm tired of it, I said. I want to come to grips with all these Rawdons. I think perhaps if I was hungry and savage, I could talk to hungry men. There's your mother, said Parload, in his slow, judicial way. That was a difficulty. I got over it by a rhetorical turn. Why should one sacrifice the future of the world? Why should one even sacrifice one's own future because one's mother is totally destitute of imagination? Section 5. It was late when I parted from Parload and came back to my own home. Our house stood in a highly respectable little square near the Clayton Parish Church. Mr. Gabbitas, the curate of all work, lodged on our ground floor, and upstairs there was an old lady, Miss Holroyd, who painted flowers on china and maintained a blind sister in an adjacent room. My mother and I lived in the basement and slept in the attics. The front of the house was veiled by a Virginian creeper that defied the Clayton air and clustered in untidy, dependent masses over the wooden porch. As I came up the steps, I had a glimpse of Mr. Gravitas, printing photographs by candlelight in his room. It was the chief delight of his little life to spend his holiday abroad in the company of queer little snapshot camera, and to return with a great multitude of foggy and sinister negatives that he made in beautiful and interesting places. These the camera company would develop for him on advantageous terms, and he would spend his evenings the year through in printing from them in order to inflict copies upon his undeserving friends. There was a long frame full of his work in the Clayton National School, for example, inscribed in old English lettering, Italian Travel Pictures by the Reverend E. B. Gabbitas. For this it seemed he lived and travelled and has had his being. It was his only real joy. By his shaded light I could see his sharp little nose, his pale little eyes behind his glasses, his mouth pursed up with the endeavour of his employment. Hireling liar, muttered, for was he not also part of the system, part of the scheme of robbery that made wage serfs of Parload and me, though his share in the proceedings was certainly small. Hireling liar, I said, standing in the darkness, outside even his faint glow of travelled culture. My mother let me in. She looked at me, mutely, because she knew there was something wrong, and it was no use for her to ask what. Good night, mummy, said I, and kissed her a little roughly, and lit and took my candle and went off at once up the staircase to bed, not looking back at her. I've kept some supper for you, dear. Don't want any supper. But, dearie, good night, mother. And I went up and slammed my door upon her, blew out my candle, and lay down at once upon my bed. Lay there a long time before I got up to undress. There were times when that dumb beseeching of my mother's face irritated me unspeakably. It did so that night. I felt I had to struggle against it, that it could not exist if I gave way to its pleadings, and it hurt me and divided me to resist it, almost beyond endurance. It was clear to me that I had to think out for myself religious problems, social problems, questions of conduct, questions of expediency, that her poor, dear, simple beliefs could not help me at all, that she did not understand. Hers was the accepted religion. Her only social ideas were blind submissions to the accepted order, to lawyers, to doctors, to clergymen, lawyers, masters, and all respectable persons in authority over us. And with her to believe was to fear. She knew from a thousand little signs, though still at times I went to church with her, that I was passing out of touch of all these things that ruled her life, into some terrible unknown. From things I said she could infer such clumsy concealments as I made. She felt my socialism, felt my spirit in revolt against the accepted order, felt the impotent resentments that filled me with bitterness against all she held sacred. Yet, you know, it was not her dear gods she sought to defend so much as me. She seemed always to be wanting to say to me, "Dear, I know it's hard, but revolt is harder. Don't make war on it, dear, don't. Don't do anything to offend it. I'm sure it will hurt you if you do. It will hurt you if you do." She had been cowed into submission, as so many women of that time had been, by the sheer brutality of the accepted thing. The existing order had dominated her into a worship of abject observances. It had bent her, aged her, robbed her of eyesight, so that at 55 she peered through cheap spectacles at my face, and saw it only dimly, filled her with a habit of anxiety, made her hands, her poor dear hands. Not in the whole world now could you find a woman with hands so grimy, so needle-worn, so misshapen by toil, so chapped and coarsened, so evilly entreated. At any rate, there is this that I can say for myself, that my bitterness against the world and fortune was for her sake as well as for my own. Yet that night I pushed by her harshly. I answered her curtly, left her concerned and perplexed in the passage, and slammed my door upon her. And for a long time I lay raging at the hardship and evil of life, at the contempt of Rawdon and the loveless coolness of Nettie's letter, at my weakness and insignificance, at the things I found intolerable, and the things I could not mend. Over and over went my poor little brain, tired out and unable to stop on my treadmill of troubles. Nettie, Rawdon, my mother, Gabbitas, Nettie. Suddenly I came upon emotional exhaustion. Some clock was striking midnight. After all, I was young. I had these quick transitions. I remember quite distinctly. I stood up abruptly, undressed very quickly in the dark, and had hardly touched my pillow again before I was asleep. But how my mother slept that night, I do not know. Oddly enough, I did not blame myself for behaving like this to my mother, though my conscience blames me acutely for my arrogance to Parload. I regret my behaviour to my mother before the days of the change. It is a scar among my memories that will always be a little painful to the end of my days. But I do not see how something of the sort was to be escaped under those former conditions. In that time of muddle and obscurity, people were overtaken by needs and toil and hot passions before they had the chance of even a year or so of clear thinking. They settled down to an intense and strenuous application to some partial but immediate duty, and the growth of thought ceased in them. They set and hardened into narrow ways. Few women remain capable of a new idea after 25, few men after 31 or 32. Discontent with the thing that existed was regarded as immoral. It was certainly an annoyance, and the only protest against it, the only effort against that universal tendency in all human institutions to thicken and clog, to work loosely and badly, to rust and weaken towards catastrophes, came from the young, the crude, unmerciful young. It seemed in those days to thoughtful men the harsh law of being, that either we must submit to our elders and be stifled, or disregard them, disobey them, thrust them aside, and make our little step of progress before we too were ossified and became obstructive in our turn. My pushing against my mother, my responsive departure to my own silent meditations, was, I now perceive, a figure of the whole hard relationship between parents and son in those days. There appeared no other way. That perpetually recurring tragedy was, it seemed, part of the very nature of the progress of the world. We did not think then that minds might grow ripe without growing rigid, or children honour their parents and still think for themselves. We were angry and hasty because we were stifled in the darkness in a poisoned and vitiated air. That deliberate animation of the intelligence which is now the universal quality, that vigour with consideration, that judgment with confident enterprise which shine all through our world, were things disintegrated and unknown in the corrupting atmosphere of our former state. So the first fascicle ended. I put it aside and looked for a second. Well, said the man who wrote, this is fiction. It's my story. But you, amidst this beauty, you're not this ill-conditioned, squalidly bred lad of whom I'm reading. He smiled. There intervenes a certain change, he said. Have I not hinted at that? I hesitated upon a question, then saw the second fascicle at hand and picked it up. Chapter the Second. Nettie. Section 1. I cannot now remember, the story resumed, what intervals separated that evening on which Parload first showed me the comet. I think I only pretended to see it then, and the Sunday afternoon I spent at Chexel. Between the two, there was time enough for me to give notice and leave Rawdon's, to seek for some other situation very strenuously in vain, to think and say many hard and violent things to my mother and to Parload, and to pass through some phases of very profound wretchedness. There must have been a passionate correspondence with Nettie, but all the fluff, froth, and fury of that has faded now out of my memory. All I have clear now is that I wrote one magnificent farewell to her, casting her off forever, and that I got in reply a prim little note to say that if ever there was to be an end to everything, that was no excuse for writing such things as I had done. And then I think I wrote again in a vein I considered satirical. To that she did not reply. That interval was at least 3 weeks, and probably 4, because the comet, which had been on the first occasion only a dubious speck in the sky, certainly visible only when it was magnified, was now a great white presence, brighter than Jupiter and casting a shadow on its own account. It was now actively present in the world of human thought. Everyone was talking about it. Everyone was looking for its waxing splendor as the sun went down. The papers, the music halls, the hoardings echoed it. Yes, the comet was already dominant before I went over to make everything clear to Nettie. And Parload had spent £200 in buying himself a spectroscope. Said he could see for himself, night after night, that mysterious, that stimulating line, the unknown line in the green. How many times did I look at the smidgy, quivering symbol of the unknown things that were rushing upon us out of the inhuman void before I rebelled? But at last I could stand it no longer, and I reproached Parload very bitterly for wasting his time in astronomical dilettantism. Here, said I, we are on the verge of the biggest lockout in the history of this countryside. His distress and hunger coming, here's all the capitalistic competitive system like a wound inflamed, and you spend your time gaping at that damned silly streak of nothing in the sky. Parload stared at me. Yes, I do, he said slowly, as though it was a new idea. Don't I? I wonder why. I want to start meetings of an evening on Howden's Waste. You think they'd listen? They'd listen fast enough now. They didn't before, said Parload, looking at his pet instrument. There was a demonstration of unemployed at Swathingley on Sunday. They got to stone throwing. Parload said nothing for a little while, and I said several things. He seemed to be considering something. But after all, he said at last, with an awkward movement towards his spectroscope, that does signify something. The comet? Yes. What can it signify? You don't want me to believe in astrology. What does it matter what flames in the heavens when men are starving on the earth? It's science. Science. What we want now is socialism, not science. He still seemed reluctant to give up his comet. Socialism's all right, he said. But if that thing up there was to hit the earth, it might matter. Nothing matters but human beings. Suppose it killed them all. Oh, said I, that's rot. I wonder, said Parload, dreadfully divided in his allegiance. He looked at the comet. He seemed on the verge of repeating his growing information about the nearness of the paths of the Earth and the comet, and all that might ensue from that. So I cut in with something I had gotten out of a now far forgotten writer called Ruskin, a volcano of beautiful language and nonsensical suggestions, who prevailed very greatly with eloquent, excitable young men in those days. Something it was about the insignificance of science and the supreme importance of life. Pollard stood listening, half turned towards the sky with the tips of his fingers on his spectroscope. He seemed to come to a sudden decision. "No, I don't agree with you, Ledford," he said. "You don't understand about science." Pollard rarely argued with that bluntness of opposition. I was so used to entire possession of our talk that his brief contradiction struck me like a blow. "Don't agree with me?" I repeated. "No," said Pollard. "But how?" "I believe science is of more importance than socialism," he said. "Socialism is a theory. Science? Science is something more." And that was really all he seemed to be able to say. We embarked upon one of those queer arguments illiterate young men always used to find so heating. Science or socialism. It was, of course, like arguing which is right, left-handedness or a taste for onions. It was an altogether impossible opposition. But the range of my rhetoric enabled me at last to exasperate Pollard, and his mere repudiation of my conclusion sufficed to exasperate me, and we ended in the key of a positive quarrel. "Oh, very well," said I, "as long as we know where we are." I slammed his door as though I'd dynamited his house and went raging down the street. But I felt that he was already back at the window, worshipping his blessed line in the green before I got around the corner. I had to walk for an hour or so before I was cool enough to go home. And it was Pollard who had first introduced me to socialism. Recreant. The most extraordinary things used to run through my head in those days. I'll confess that my mind ran persistently that evening upon revolutions after the best French pattern, and I sat on a committee of safety and tried backsliders. Pollard was there among the prisoners. Backsliderismus. Aware too late of the error of his ways. His hands were tied behind his back, ready for the shambles. Through the open door, one heard the voice of justice, the rude justice of the people. I was sorry, but I had to do my duty. "If we punish those who would betray us to kings," said I, with a sorrowful deliberation, "how much the more we must punish those who would give over to the state, to the pursuit of useless knowledge." And so with a gloomy satisfaction sent him off to the guillotines. Ah, Pollard, Pollard, if only you'd listened to me earlier, Pollard. Nonetheless, the quarrel made me extremely unhappy. Pollard was my only gossip, and it cost me much to keep away from him, and think evil of him with no one to listen to me, evening after evening. That was a very miserable time for me, even before my last visit to Chexhill. My long, unemployed hours hung heavily on my hands. I kept away from home all day, partly to support a fiction that I was sedulously seeking in another situation, and partly to escape the persistent question in my mother's eyes. "Why did you quarrel with Mr. Rawdon? Why did you? Why do you keep on going on about with a sullen face and risk offending it more?" I spent most of the morning in the newspaper room of the public library, writing impossible applications for impossible posts. I remember that among other things of the sort, I offered my services to a firm of private detectives, a sinister breed of traders upon base jealousies now happily vanished from the world, and wrote apropos of an advertisement for stevedores that I did not know what the duties of a stevedore might be, but that I was apt and willing to learn. And in the afternoons and evenings, I wandered through the strange lights and shadows of my native valley, and hated all created things. Until my wanderings were checked by the discovery that I was wearing out my boots. The stagnant, inconclusive malaria of that time. I perceived that I was an evil-tempered, ill-disposed youth with a great capacity for hatred, but there was an excuse for hate. It was wrong of me to hate individuals, to be rude, harsh, and vindictive to this person or that. But indeed, it would have been equally wrong to have taken the manifest offer life made me without resentment. I see now clearly and calmly what I felt then obscurely, and with an unbalanced intensity, that my conditions were intolerable. My work was tedious and laborious, and it took up an unreasonable proportion of my time. I was ill-clothed, ill-fed, ill-housed, ill-educated, and ill-trained. My will was suppressed and cramped to the pitch of torture. I had no reasonable pride in myself, no reasonable chance of putting anything right. It was a life hardly worth living. That a large proportion of the people about me had no better lot, that many had a worse, does not affect these facts. It was a life in which contentment would have been disgraceful. If some of them were contented or resigned, so much the worse for everyone. No doubt it was hasty and foolish of me to throw up my situation, but everything was so obviously aimless and foolish in our social organization that I did not feel disposed to blame myself even for that, except insofar it pained my mother and caused her anxiety. Think of one comprehensive fact of the lockout. That year was a bad year, a year of worldwide economic disorganization. Through their want of intelligent direction, the great Trust of American Ironmasters, a gang of energetic, narrow-minded furnace owners, had smelted far more iron than the whole world had any demand for. In those days, there existed no means of estimating any need of that sort beforehand. They had done this without even consulting the ironmasters of any other country. During the period of activity, they had drawn into their employment a great number of workers and had erected a huge productive plant. It is manifestly just that people who do the headlong stupid things of this sort should suffer. But in the old days, it was quite possible. It was customary for the real blunderers in such disasters to shift nearly all the consequences of their incapacity. No one thought it wrong for a light-witted captain of industry who had led his workpeople into overproduction, into the disproportionate manufacture, that is to say, of some particular article, to abandon and dismiss them. Nor was there anything to prevent the sudden frantic underselling of some trade rival in order to surprise and destroy his trade, secure his customers for one's own destined needs, and shift a portion of one's punishment upon him. The operation of spasmodic underselling was known as dumping. The American ironmasters were now dumping on the British market. The British employers were, of course, taking their loss out of their workpeople as much as possible. But in addition, they were agitating for some legislation that would prevent not stupid relative excess in production, but dumping. Not the disease, but the consequence of the disease. The necessary knowledge to prevent either dumping or its causes. The uncorrelated production of commodities did not exist. But this hardly weighed with them at all, and in answer to their demands there had been arisen a curious party of retaliatory protectionists, who combined vague proposals for spasmodic responses to these convulsive attacks from foreign manufacturers, and with the very evident intention of achieving financial adventures. The dishonest and reckless elements were indeed so evident in this movement as to add very greatly to the general atmosphere of distrust and insecurity, and in the recoil from the prospect of fiscal power in the hands of the class of the men known as new financiers. One heard frightened, old-fashioned statesmen asserting with passion that dumping didn't occur, or that it was a very charming sort of thing to happen. Nobody would face and handle the rather intricate truth of the business. The whole effect upon the mind of a cool observer was of a covey of unsubstantial jabbering minds drifting over a series of irrational economic cataclysms. Prices and employment tumbled about like towers in an earthquake, and amidst the shifting masses were the common workpeople going on with their lives as well as they could, suffering, perplexed, unorganized, and for anything but violent, fruitless protests, impotent. You cannot hope now to understand the infinite want of adjustment in the old order of things. At one time there were people dying of actual starvation in India, while men were burning unsaleable wheat in America. It sounds like the account of a particularly mad dream, does it not? It was a dream. A dream from which no one on earth expected an awakening. To us youngsters, with the positiveness, the rationalism of youth, it seemed that the strikes and lockouts, the overproduction and misery could not possibly result simply from ignorance and want of thought and feeling. We needed more dramatic factors than these mental fogs, these mere atmospheric devils. We fled, therefore, to the common refuge of the unhappy ignorant, a belief in callous insensate plots. We called them plots against the poor. You can still see how we figured it in any museum by looking up the caricatures of capital and labor that adorned the German and American socialistic papers of the time. And with that unexpectedly revolutionary bent, I really did not expect this in an H.G. Wells novel, although I'm quite pleased, I'm going to call it a night. As always, if you want to pick up where I've left off and carry on reading these adventures and figure out what actually is going to happen with the comet, you can find it on Project Gutenberg at the link in the show notes. Thanks again for joining me on this episode of Sleepy Time Tales, the podcast designed around a bedtime story to help you to get a restful night. New episodes will be released every Sunday night to give you something fresh to help you rest in a new week. But make sure to subscribe in whatever service you use so that you get your new episodes whenever they come out. A reminder that the music for tonight is Sweet Night and Friends by Kumiko. Check out more of their work on their website, which we'll find linked in the show notes. Good night, and sweet dreams.